Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Werke, Judge Tracy Smith, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is May 7, 2025. This panel of the court has five cases on our calendar today, two of which will be submitted with oral argument and three of which will be submitted without oral argument solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is case number A24-1379. State of Minnesota versus Victor Zuniga Gonzalez. Counsel, I assume, are familiar with our standard procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. The lectern is adjustable. There's some buttons on the front edge that you can use to adjust it up or down. Counsel for appellant, you may approach, and please, at the beginning, introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument.
Good morning. My name is Amber Johnson. I represent the appellate, Mr. Victor Zuniga Gonzalez. The prosecution in this case committed numerous acts of prosecutorial misconduct. Cases of allegations of inappropriate sexual conduct with a minor are arguably the most emotionally charged types of cases in our criminal justice system. People have very strong feelings about people who commit these types of crimes. That cannot be allowed to be used as a weapon by the state to convict a defendant. Unlike other person crimes where there may be self-defense as a defense or alibis, there really is no defense to this type of crime other than, I didn't do it. This is not true. These are special cases, and the court should handle them as such. Here, the prosecutorial misconduct of improper burden shifting and improperly commenting on the credibility of witnesses risked weaponizing the jury, the emotions of the jury against the appellant.
I understand your argument. I think these cases are very important because of that. I hate the phrase he said, she said, but you know, it's a credibility call. And certainly you agree that prosecutors have leeway in order to argue that particular witnesses were not credible. I mean, you agree with that, right?
I do.
And why then in this context, when the prosecutor was saying none of the witnesses can think of a reason on why she was there and some of the other comments that came up, why was that so impermissible? What boundary did that cross other than trying to allow the trier of fact, the jurors, to hear the credibility concerns?
Raising that topic, it is burden shifting, though, because it is implying that Mr. Gonzalez had to have a reason why she was lying, that was required in order for the jury to find him not guilty. There are different ways that it could be phrased and different ways that it could come up in the argument, but that wasn't how it was addressed in this case. He directly asked the appellate two times on cross-examination about why is she lying? And he didn't have a response. And then he went, and that happened at the very end of the defense.
Why is that burden shifting? Because the jurors are able to say, well, you know, they use their own common sense, and they say, well, could there be a reason? And she's a young girl. She could, you know, make things up. I mean, isn't that where they weigh that credibility, and all that is putting it at the doorstep of the jurors?
I think that it can be confusing for the jury about what the burden is, because I understand that the jurors were instructed that the defendant has no burden of proof. But by implying that there is, instead of just outright misstating it and being corrected by that outright misstatement, there is this it can be confusing about to the jury as to whether or not they need that answer in order to be able to find the defendant not guilty. Because it's subtle, but it is something that does very arguably probably come up in jury deliberation. We don't know what happens in that room, and we don't know what the focus is of the jurors there. In this case, you know, there was, the defense attorney did contest the evidence of the chlamydia test. There was a wrong name on the test results. And it really was about credibility. And arguably, the state's witness did not remember a whole lot. And so saying, I don't remember or I don't know. And so it was a credibility issue. And by inferring that, by taking the stand, the defendant somehow has to have an answer for that question, it does, I think, improperly shift at least a burden or opens the door to shift the burden to the jurors when they're sitting back in the jury room trying to figure out what they think happened, who is credible, who wasn't credible.
I think you'd have a stronger argument if he did not testify, but he did testify. Are you saying, arguing, or suggesting that in the closing argument the prosecutor did not accurately describe the testimony?
No, I am not saying that. I'm saying that the questions that he asked of the defendant when he did testify were inappropriate, and then he used those questions and the answers provided in his closing argument to double down on the inappropriate conduct.
So you're arguing that he should not have asked. So the misconduct both in the examination and in the argument?
Yes. And I would add that the defense didn't argue that there was a motive to lie. The defense just simply was arguing that it didn't happen, that the defendant was telling his version of the story and that that is what happened. So, and that the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that what the allegations were, in fact, happened.
Go ahead. I had a question that was comes from the same place as Judge Johnson's question, which is that this was in the respondent's brief. This was part of the testimony of the defendant. What if defendant didn't testify and said other witnesses testified similarly? Did you ever see any problem between them? No, they got along great. They got along great. They never had any issues. And then the prosecution asked him, well, can you think of any reason why she would make this up? Same thing, only it's a different witness. Is that also shifting the burden?
I think it is, because you're still asking, essentially, why did they lie or did they lie question to a witness, whether it's the defendant or another witness for the defense, it still carries with it the same result, is that there's some sort of burden shifted to the defense that they have to prove or at least raise some arguable or colorable argument that there's a reason why this story is made up and not truthful. So I think it applies to all witnesses. Now, I think there are ways you can ask those questions and just leave them hanging, that you can then say in a more general way that the evidence didn't provide any reason why, any motive to lie. That's different than what the prosecutor did in this case, though. He said their witnesses couldn't come up with a reason, the defendant couldn't come up with a reason, and really focused on that it was their duty to do that.
Isn't that just a way of pointing out the weakness in the opposing party's argument?
Not the way he said it. I think you can do it, but not the way it was done here. And that's kind of the crutch of my argument. Is I'm not saying that there isn't the ability to argue that there isn't evidence of motive. But by saying it, words matter. The way you say things to people matter. And by saying it the way he did in his closing argument and the way he did directly to the defendant, he said it in a way that shifted the burden. There are other ways he could have said it where I wouldn't have the same arguments that I have right now. I'd also like to point out that Mr. Zuniga did not did not make the minor's credibility focus in his argument. He simply denied the allegations against him. And in doing so, it doesn't open the door to the why did she lie questions that were asked of him.
But your theory of the case, though, it is a broader theory of your case because, and this gets into another part of your argument, but, you know, you questioned the lack of memory that the young woman had in this case, that she didn't know when she stayed at her aunt's, she didn't remember exactly what had happened. So, you know, in a way, you've opened that door in terms of pointing out those deficiencies by the state's witness. And so it seems as if that door is open for the state then to come back and say, well, what difference does it make? And that type of discourse that went on.
Are you talking about where the issue is whether or not he was disparaging the defense?
I've turned the discussion to that. But, I mean, that's part of your broad, and that's why these cases are so hard. Your broad theory of the case is she made it up. She can't remember, and because she can't remember, that proves she made it up. And that broad theory you've applied to all of the prosecutorial misconduct claims, including the assertion that the prosecutor disparaged defense counsel.
Well, and that is what's difficult about these cases, because it is a credibility issue most of the time. Maybe there are some corroborating bits of evidence, some are stronger than others, but sometimes it simply is a case about credibility. But there are ways to attack credibility by using the evidence, and then there's ways that were done in this case where it's kind of flippant statements about the defendant's case and the defendant's arguments about credibility.
Such as, give me an example of what you found to be the most provocative comment that was made by the state.
Well, when it comes to this particular issue, I would say the no offense, but who cares? I mean, he could have simply said, the defense is trying to cloud the issue by putting in, you know, talking about all the inconsistencies around the event.
So to kind of take your words, you're saying the flip prefatory comments of no offense and who cares, that kind of thing, that's what you found to be objectionable?
I think, yes, with regards to the defense and the defense attorney. And in doing so, he was disparaging the role of the defense attorney by saying, well, everything that he just did up here, it doesn't matter. But he was saying it probably in the most, colloquially, the no offense, but you're going to say something offensive afterwards. And it's just a polite way of trying to say you're not offending them, but you know the thing that you're saying after it is going to offend them. But not only did the prosecutor do that in this case, he then followed it up with a who cares? Who cares about this? Who cares about this? Who cares about this? And yes, he refocused, but he still said those things and disparaged the job of the defense attorney and the defendant's case and defense in general. There's also the argument seems to say that the prosecutor's argument seems to say that you have to find that the minor is lying in order to provide a not guilty verdict in this case. But that's not necessarily, that is not the standard, and it's not what is held. The burden is on the state to prove the case. Even if the jurors believed KGC, they might have found that the prosecutor did not prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. They might have believed some things about her statements and other things they didn't believe. They might have believed some things about Mr. Zuniga Gonzalez's statements and some things they didn't believe. We don't know where they put weight in the credibility of their testimony. Ultimately, I think the broad issue here is that with all the different things the prosecutor did that were impermissible by burden shifting or implying that there was a burden on the defendant, by going after the credibility of the defendant right to his face, the very last thing that was said before the defense rested their case, and then turning around and hitting both of those things in his closing arguments pretty strongly, there is a strong argument that could confuse the jury as to what the burden was, what they needed to be able to decide, how much weight they should give to those statements when they're back in the jury room, and could have very well affected their verdict in this case. I would like to add, I also brought up the issue of appealing to the emotions of the jurors. And in closing arguments, the prosecutor did generalize this crime, that this is the world we live in, this happens to kids, people do this to kids, and that Mr. Zuniga Gonzalez did this to KGC. In doing that, he inflamed the emotions that there are bad people out here, this is a bad person. Our world has bad people in it, and that's him. And in doing so, he was trying to invoke the emotions that people hold very strongly and have very strong opinions of, and that was improper. And in such, deprived Mr. Zuniga Gonzalez of a fair trial in this matter. Thank you.
Good morning to the court and counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Britta Nicholson. I am appearing today on behalf of the state of Minnesota, who is the respondent in this matter. Appellant's claims stem from his unwillingness to recognize four well-settled principles. First, that prosecutors are permitted to respond to evidence and arguments presented by the defense. Second, prosecutors are permitted to make arguments regarding witness credibility. Especially true in a case, as appellant points out this morning, where credibility is the central focus of the trial. Third, prosecutors are permitted to argue that a defense theory lacks merit or lacks support. And finally, a prosecutor has considerable latitude and is not required to make a colorless argument. Within this established legal framework, appellant cannot carry his burden to demonstrate plain error that contravenes case law, a rule, or a standard of conduct. For every argument raised in appellant's brief, there is on point precedential case law that authorizes the state's comments in this case. I'll begin with the burden-shifting argument regarding whether or not the victim had a motive or reason to fabricate the allegations. I would point this court to State v. Fields, which is from the Minnesota Supreme Court 2007. In that case, the prosecutor used language almost identical to this case, wherein the prosecutor's closing argument, he pointed out that the defendant denied assaulting the victim, quote, he couldn't come up with why he thought the victim would do this. And the Supreme Court held that all of the allegedly objectionable statements discussed the credibility of the witnesses in the context of the evidence before the court and the conclusions that could be drawn from that evidence. The prosecutor raised the issue of the motive for the victim to lie in the context of credibility, and therefore these statements were not misconduct. Regarding appellant's argument regarding allegedly attacking the appellant's credibility during cross-examination by referring to his version of events, I would point this court to State v. Wright, which is the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2006, which rejected an almost identical argument that the prosecutor's overall theme, that the defendant's account of what occurred was a lie, was an improper comment on the defendant's credibility and character. Instead, the Supreme Court held that the state properly analyzed the evidence and argued that a particular witness was not credible. Moving on to appellant's argument about belittling the defense with the statement or the rhetorical question, who cares? I would point this court to State v. Starkey, Minnesota Supreme Court, 1994, which addressed an almost identical argument. In that case, the Supreme Court held that it was not prosecutorial error when the prosecutor stated the defense was trying to, quote, divert your attention from the real facts, the real logic, and the real common sense of this case. The court found it was not error because the statement properly called into question an anticipated defense argument which was in fact made. And that's what we have in this.
Colorful. I mean, you know, if you went on through the entire presentation, and I realize it wasn't frequently stated, but if you would go, who cares, who cares? I mean, your tone would convey a disregard to defense counsel by doing that, wouldn't you think?
I wouldn't say we necessarily need to assume that. You know, in this case, we are just looking at the black and white page of a transcript. We don't have tone. We don't have delivery. And, you know, he did preface it with no offense to the defense. And I don't think we can read a sarcastic tone into that as we sit here looking at the transcript. I think what we should do is take it at face value, is that he telegraphed to the jury and to this court that the intent of that comment was not disparagement. He was not speaking ill of defense counsel personally or, you know, disparaging his work on the case. He was basically trying to convey to the jury that that argument is not where your focus should be. It should not be something you assign weight to. And instead, let's refocus on the evidence, the consistent allegations of what happened on July 1st of that year. And I think that is abundantly clear from then the immediate segue where the prosecutor went in and described all the consistent evidence of the assault itself. And for the second who cares statement was when they were discussing the medical evidence in the case. So the prosecutor was merely saying, you know, we don't need you to focus on or give weight to the fact that there were some minor inconsistencies in her recollection of the medical appointments. Here's what really matters. Let's focus on her symptoms, her chlamydia diagnosis, which is consistent with the defendant's diagnosis. So it was just the prosecutor saying, I'm not intending any disparagement here. I just want you to focus on the most relevant evidence of the defendant's guilt. And another precedential case that is on point on this is an analogy when prosecutors call an argument a red herring. That presumably could be considered offensive or disparaging, but the Minnesota Court of Appeals in the Moseng case rejected that claim and found no prosecutorial misconduct when the prosecutor used the phrase red herring. So these are phrases and general themes that have been explicitly authorized by appellate courts in this state.
What is, counsel, what is the statement to which you're comparing us in the first case? Is it Starkey? Is that what you said?
Yes, Your Honor. The statement that the prosecutor made in that case was that the defense was trying to divert your attention from the real facts, the real logic, and the real common sense of this case. I also cited some cases in my brief where they were using language of they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes. This is a smokescreen. I think those are much more colorful than the language used here. But appellate courts have affirmed and said that language is acceptable because it is trying to refocus the jury on the relevant evidence in the case and encouraging the jury not to be distracted by arguments or evidence that don't have bearing on the elements of the offense. Moving on to the appellant's argument about allegedly inflaming the passions and prejudices of the jury by raising societal issues, I would point this court to State v. Carter from the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1979, in which they recognized that part of a prosecutor's argument in a sexual abuse case will innately run the risk of evoking sympathy for the victim. That's just human nature and something that will happen. However,
what case did you rely on?
This is State v. Carter, 289 North. But what you need to look at is the prosecutor's purpose in making those statements. And in State v. Carter, just like in this case, they concluded that the purpose of the argument was not to evoke sympathy, but to counter an anticipated defense argument regarding the victim's credibility, and therefore the argument did not constitute misconduct. And that's what we have in this case. The comment about how, in general, recognizing that adults do sexually abuse children, that was well embedded in the prosecutor's discussion of the specific witness credibility factors that the jury gave to the jury, that the court gave to the jury in the jury instructions, in which it talked about the believability of the victim's testimony in light of all of the other evidence. And this was anticipation of a defense argument that was in fact made, that these allegations were outlandish and unbelievable. The defense compared them to Chernobyl and a nuclear disaster. And the prosecutor was merely grounding the jury in the reality that this is not something uncommon and explosive. This is something that unfortunately does happen in the world, and it's in the world we all live in. He wasn't excluding the defendant with that language. He was saying we all live in a world where, unfortunately, adults do sexually abuse children. And that is not inflammatory. That is quite frankly, acknowledging the jurors' common experience, their common sense, and was an apt prediction of an argument that the defense was going to make. And then finally, regarding appellant's argument about alignment with the jury, I did just previously reference that, but the case I was referring to was Nunn v. State from the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2008, which makes it very clear that not every use of the word we or us is automatically prosecutorial error, and that as long as the word we does not exclude the defendant and applies as a blanket term to everybody in the courtroom, prosecutors are free to use that language. And then recognizing that this is an unpublished case, State v. Danqua from the Minnesota Court of Appeals in 2019, I do believe is persuasive due to how similar it is to the language in this case, in which this court upheld the exact same language, quote, "that's the world we live in a closing argument in a child sexual abuse case," because it wasn't excluding the defendant. It was merely recognizing that we live in a type of world where bad things happen to children, and so the jury can consider that common sense and common experience in their deliberations. And moving on now, too, as part of the plain error analysis, as I stated earlier, there is such a wealth of case law that makes it very clear that these types of statements that the prosecutor made are acceptable, are within their wide latitude to make their case and defend against the defense's attacks on the prosecutor's case. But so all of the allegations here do not contravene well-settled law. The well-settled law is actually very strongly on the state's side in this case. But even if this court concludes that any of the prosecutor's comments were improper, appellant is not entitled to relief because the comments did not affect the appellant's substantial rights. Looking at the factors outlined in case law, the strength of the state's case. The state had a very strong case against the defendant in this case. The victim's testimony was consistent throughout her multiple disclosures, all the way from her mother to medical professionals to Coroner House to her testimony on the stand. Her timeline of events of that day was corroborated by appellant himself, who even admitted to being alone in his apartment with the victim that night, by family members corroborating the timeline and location. The genital-to-genital contact described by the victim was corroborated by medical evidence regarding the STIs, and the delayed disclosure rationale that the victim gave was corroborated by the Coroner House expert's testimony. Also, this conduct was not pervasive. These were brief, fleeting moments during one question during cross-examination and then a few statements in the state's closing argument. In addition, the defense had opportunity to rebut these statements. For the cross-examination allegations, though, they had redirect. They had their closing argument. For the concerns about the state's initial closing argument, the defense attorney could easily rebut any concerns in their own closing argument and did, in fact, do so regarding the burden-shifting argument. The defense attorney reminded the jury that the state bears the sole burden of proof. And in addition, the jury instructions in this case made it very, very clear about what the jury's duty was, what the burden of proof was, so there was no risk, as appellant claims, that the jury would be confused or misled or blinded by the prosecutor's comments in this case. There were extensive instructions about the burden of proof, and even one that I highlighted in my brief where the judge used an example saying that the defendant and defense counsel could sit at counsel table, say absolutely nothing during the entire trial, and that would be fine because that's how strong the state's burden of proof is. So there is no risk that this affected the appellant's substantial rights or affected the outcome of the case if this court does find that the statements were burden shifting. There were also instructions that what the lawyers say is not evidence. There were instructions to disregard any attorney statements that conflict with the law that the judge gave the jury. There were instructions that jurors should rely on their life experience and common sense. And the witness credibility factors were very clearly delineated in the jury instructions. And if you look at the framework of the prosecutor's closing argument, he basically used those as a template to walk through and discuss why the victim's testimony was credible. And all of the alleged errors were made within that framework. But it was very clear that the prosecutor was arguing about the victim's credibility and applying the jury instructions to the facts of this case, to the evidence of this case, and much of which was elicited by the defense counsel during their examination of their own witnesses, and thereby opened the door for the prosecutor to respond. For example, the defense attorney asked multiple witnesses about whether they observed any problems or conflict between the victim and the defendant. So the prosecutor had every right to follow up on that evidence elicited by the defense counsel and clarify its bearing on the victim's credibility, which is exactly what the prosecutor did in this case. In addition, the defendant did take the stand. He did choose to testify, and he stated that the allegations never happened and that the victim was fabricating these allegations. When he did that, he made it very clear what his defense and his theory of the case was, and the prosecutor was well within his wide latitude to respond to that defense and to point out that there was no support for that defense in the record. So for all of those reasons, I would ask this court to affirm appellant's conviction. I do have about a minute and a half left, but I would waive the rest of that time unless there are additional questions from this court. Thank you.
The respondent talked about Stacey Fields in the burden shifting issue. In that case, the court did say that they kind of held their decision on the fact that there was no explicit misstatement of the burden. Justice Page, in his dissent in that case, disagreed and said that just implying that there was a burden shift should have been good enough to find that the prosecutor's statements were misconduct. Additionally, other cases have used the word imply and not required an explicit misstatement of the facts, such as State v. Martin.
It seems very difficult in that context with that language couldn't come up with in another case, even though there's a dissent to say that error is plain here. I mean, it was unobjected to. What could make that plain given that Supreme Court case?
I believe that since that case, there has been, such as State v. Martin, the court has looked at not necessarily that an explicit misstatement needs to be said, but also that implying that there's a burden shifting is good enough to find misconduct. And that in cases where that might be true, that there is case law that says, well, since there was a jury instruction read to the jury, that, you know, we're going to say that they presume that they followed the law, and even though there was misconduct in implying that there was a burden shift, we aren't going to find that it had any substantial effect on the jury's verdict. But in Justice Page's dissent, he cites a case that says that even when jury instructions are read to the jury, there could be confusion of the jury as to whether or not what exactly the burden is and whether or not they have to find that the defense provided at least some information, and that it can be confusing to the jury as to, well, is this an explicit burden shifting, or is it just something that we need to consider in our opinion or in our verdict? And I would say that's the problem with these cases, is that there's not an explicit burden shifting, because most prosecutors would not just clearly say, like, he did not show this, therefore you have to find him guilty. But there is the implication that there needs to be an answer to this question. And that is confusing, I think, to the jury, arguably very confusing to the jury, especially in credibility situations. The state has a fabulous argument of why the defendant would lie, because he's facing criminal charges. So, but they don't have to, the defense doesn't have to say why the alleged victim might be lying. Who knows? The question is, can the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed the crime that they're charging him with? And by implying that he is required to provide some information, I think that there is a confusion, even when it's read to the jury that there is no burden on the defendant, especially when he does take the stand.
Ms. Johnson, I think you acknowledge that the plain air standard applies, and I think generally, typically, the best way for a defendant appellant to show plain air is to identify a prior opinion that identified an error of the same type. And so, I mean, what's your best case or cases, that do show error in a particular comment that resembles a comment in this case?
It would be Mayhorn. In that there was, I would argue,
so the fourth part of your argument?
Yes, yeah. And that the cumulative effect of this, there are multiple misconducts by the prosecutor that ultimately deprived Mr. Zuniga Gonzalez of a fair trial. And I will add that
the comments in Mayhorn were pretty dramatic, scandalous perhaps even, but I mean, do we have something similar here?
Well, the sexual assault cases, I argue, are different. A lot of the cases that are cited by the state in this brief are murder cases or assault cases. And it's a different type of case where the witnesses are different, the evidence is different, there is a dead person that they know something happened. And so I think that these particular cases have to have special attention paid to them as to how these misconducts by the prosecution can affect the jury's decision.
Looks like your time has expired.
You
may sum up if you wish.
Ultimately, the passions and the motions of the jury are highly charged in these sorts of cases. And any sort of attempt on the prosecution to tug at those emotions, to inflame them, to affect how the jury may view evidence, how the jury should be perceiving evidence, is improper, especially in these types of cases. And much of the court's decisions have started to recognize that. And I think that in light of that view of these particular types of cases, some of the cases that are cited as precedent need to be looked through of the lens of the particular facts in this type of case and not necessarily what is thought of as being appropriate in a murder case or an assault case or other types of cases where the evidence is different and where the credibility of each witness is different. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within